It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. They're online, too, at harvellandcollins.com, and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are in the studio. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
And we are continuing our discussion today, Cecil.
Well, we are. We are talking about what is known in the North Carolina General Statutes as the elective share, and as like so many times in the law, the question is, what in the world do you mean by the elective share?
Mm-hmm.
And what we mean, Ben, is that in the state of North Carolina, a surviving spouse, depending on the number of years that they have been in marriage, has the right statutorily to elect a share.
Right.
To elect a portion of the estate. And this is the law, as we say, Ben. There's really no way around this, other than a few very noble exceptions. One, of course, being a prenuptial agreement.
Right.
If folks have a prenuptial agreement, then they are able, in this context, to say in that contract, in that agreement, assuming that, again, it's a bargained for and understood and agreed to contract, premarital agreement, that they waive this right to their elective share.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is no prenup, then this right arises by law out of the North Carolina General Statutes. And as we discussed some last week on the program, it depends on, again, preliminarily, the number of years in which someone has been married. If you've been married less than 10 years, then you're generally you're able to elect a share of 25% of the total net assets of the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been married 10 but less than 15, it is 33% of the total net assets. And after 15 years or more of marriage, it is then 50% of the net assets of the estate. So this is something we kind of want to continue to demystify, talk about some planning opportunities around this, make our listeners aware of this law, and also define some of the specifics within the context of the statute.
Yeah, I would imagine where this is often subject to litigation, Wes, is that people don't understand that this is outside of the will. I mean, this is no matter what the will says, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you're going to weigh that. You're going to look at, if you're representing a client who has a right to an elective share, then you're going to look at, you know, what they're taking under the will. You're going to look at what they would get through intestate succession.
Right, if there is no will. Right.
Or there is no will. Or you're going to look at the possibility of basically pulling the trigger for the right of an elective share. And obviously for your client, you're going to make a determination as to what puts them in the best situation. And you don't always know that from the beginning because, you know, you could have a situation where this is a, you know, a second marriage. A lot of times it would be a second, third marriage.
Right.
You're making the elective share. And, you know, the spouse, the surviving spouse may not have anything to do with the estate. Therefore, he or she may not know about, you know, what assets was held by, you know, their, you know, his or her spouse.
Right.
The kids might be taken care of.
Because they're not held jointly.
There could be. And what's really interesting, there's a lot of things that's interesting about this statute because it's a little bit contrary to what people, you know, out there in the public think about. The power of this statute is really incredible for folks who fall into this category. But, you know, when you look at it, it's not just the real estate that the person owned and the money in the bank. It's life insurance. It's annuities. It's retirement accounts. It's gifts within the last year of death. So it is very broad. Now, normally in an estate administration context, when we're dealing with an estate administration, life insurance, annuities, accounts with beneficiary designations, those assets really pass by operation of law to whomever those beneficiaries are.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that goes pretty quickly. But interestingly, under the elective share statute, the clerk of court has the right to claw those back into the estate for the purposes of satisfying the elective share.
Which can't be easy.
Well, it can't be easy, but I'll tell you what, the General Assembly has made it pretty easy for the clerk to do that. A lot of power in the statute for the clerk. In the event we can't work out the elective share, I mean, a lot of times what happens is it gets filed, then the estate attorney or the attorney for, you know, the other side of the case, you know, we communicate with them, and then we work out what the value of the total net assets are. Obviously, we'll be able to just apply the percentage to that to determine if what our client is entitled to, if they are the party who has the, you know, the right for the elective share, and we work it out and we enter a consent order and a release, and that gets done. But now, sometimes we can't work it out.
Right.
And sometimes we feel like assets are being hidden. And sometimes you're not telling us the whole story.
You think?
So then what we do is the statute allows us to file a petition before the clerk of court. And the petition is not just against the estate. It's against any beneficiary that may have received life insurance, you know, annuity payments, gifts within the last year of the decedent's life. Because, again, we have to give due process to everyone who would be affected by this.
Right.
And if we're going to tell a child, for example, okay, you got $250,000 of life insurance. You have to now pay that back into the estate to satisfy this elective share. Well, you have to give them that due process. They have to be a party to the action. So really the whole other side of the family would be a party to the action. So very powerful statute, but as you can imagine, it sometimes sets up a little bit of a war.
Yeah, you would think.
Well, Ben, that's what I was going to say. I mean, to dissect the scenarios that are almost always in play here, let's kind of just lay it on the table. This is usually a second spouse, second or third spouse, electing a share of an estate to the exclusion of, let's say, the natural children of the deceased spouse.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
I mean, if for some reason this is, you know, Ozzie and Harriet and their two children.
Right.
Natural children, their two children, you know, one marriage.
You're usually
this
not going to
This is really not an issue, is it?
Yeah. Okay. The surviving spouse is most often going to be left
Correct.
Everything.
Right, 100%. And eventually she's going to leave things on to their natural children. Okay, fine. But in second and third marriages where there are children from prior marriages, this statute is very much going to come into play. And so really we should, in my opinion, kind of move to, well, how do we plan around
this? Yeah.
Okay? Because Wes and I are confronted with factual situations every day, demands, wishes, objectives of clients who communicate with us, well, you know, Wes, well, Cecil, I really do not want to leave my estate all to my spouse. Okay, we're in a second marriage. We have children from a prior marriage. We've agreed to this. She has her own assets. I have my own assets. We are in a relationship now that's very meaningful to us, but we want our assets to go back to our children. Well, you know, these are good objectives and noble objectives to hear. Our first question is going to be, well, but Mr. John Doe, do we have a prenuptial?
Yes. Did you plan for this?
Did we plan for this? And, of course, so many times we then hear the answer is, oh, no, we don't have one of those things. I hear some motioning over there. Okay.
No, you're good.
Very good. All right. So we have to then talk about what are your options, Mr. John Doe. One of the options is to simply have the will, his will, outline that this is, in fact, what the spouse receives. She is to receive the elective share. And not any more than that, but not any less than that.
Right.
That is sometimes where we land, okay? In maybe I might say the more simple files. The second option is to say to John Doe, Well, you must leave your spouse this at least this elective share amount, but there are planning opportunities now for us to put this elective share amount into a trust for your wife.
Right.
And it will sit in this trust for her lifetime, and she will have the benefit of this elective share amount, keeping in mind that after 15 years, it's 50%.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah, Denise and I just celebrated 28 years, so yeah, we can pretty much count.
You're
on
in
that.
The 50% category.
Right. Congratulations.
Yeah, 15 years goes by pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Okay. And, of course, you then are able to say that this is in a trust for your surviving spouse, the elective share trust, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
She, of course, or he, has the benefit to these resources during their lifetime, but eventually they pass back to the natural children of the first to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is another planning opportunity. That is fairly critical, okay, and
right.
Very, very important, Ben, in certain factual scenarios where you have clients that have, you know, considerable assets that they're wanting to protect.
Yes, right.
We talked a little bit last week about the difference between this statute and divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Let's don't get confused here. It is absolutely true that if Mr., you know, client 70 years old inherits, you know, a couple of hundred thousand or $1 million from his parents,
right,
that is inheritance, and if they then divorce for under the divorce laws in the state of North Carolina, that inheritance might stay, or more than likely will stay, separate and distinct from the divorce. It's separate property. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This statute does not delineate,
right, it's
and
net.
Talk about
yeah.
separate property.
Yeah.
So you can have a situation here where a 50, 60-year-old inherits from their parents a significant inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
It comes into the estate of the 50, 60, 65, 70-year-old, and now they suddenly die in a marriage that's, you know, 12 years or 13 or 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that inheritance now is going to be part of the elective share.
Okay, we're talking about the planning for the elective share and how you can do that, because you're not going to get around it, but how you can plan. And we'll have that more to come in just a moment. But you can call in with your questions, too, at 800-818-2255 or our local numbers, 353-4674-247-7282. Hey, welcome back here to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are with us, and we have a caller standing by.
Barbara in Swansboro wants to ask a question.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I was wondering what would happen if, say, a person bought a house, they're married, and the wife waived her rights to the house. What happens if the husband unexpectedly dies?
How has she waived her rights in the house? Is there some document in place?
I think so.
Right before they got married?
No, this was after they were married.
Well, I think that the devil would be in the details with regard to that document. Okay, if the document just says I waive the right in the house and that's it.
She is put in his name only.
It's in his name, and she's saying,
right,
I waive my right to this house.
Not sure exactly in the details.
Well, let's just speculate about it. If that's what it says, then I think that probably would be construed in that asset would not be part of what would be counted to determine what the net estate would be for determining the value of the elective share. But that doesn't, to me, sound like a waiver of the entire elective share right. It just takes any interest with regard to that house out of the equation. That's a strange sounding document, you know, to just say I waive any rights. Because, you know, also if it's just in his name, then, you know, the property would not, by operation of law, pass directly to this spouse anyway. You know, if you buy property in a marriage and you buy it together, then that property is is titled by operation of law tenants by entirety, so it automatically goes to the surviving spouse. But this, that's not the case here. You said it's only in the husband's name.
Yeah. Right.
She has indicated she's waived any rights in that property. So probably, without having seen that document, that house would then pass under his will, if he has a will, to whomever he leaves it to, and she would have no claim in that, whether it's through elective share or otherwise.
And so let's say he hasn't updated his will. Would it go just to his family?
Well, if he has a will, it wouldn't matter if he updated
it. It depends on what his will says.
If he doesn't have a will.
If he doesn't have a will, then she's going to have a share in the house due to the statutory
intestate
succession, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She would probably, really that a document like that, that you know, we're not sitting here reading it, but it's kind of setting up for some court interpretation, unfortunately. I think one side may say, well, this doesn't upset my right to my intestate succession or my elective share, and the other side would say, well, at least takes the house out of the equation, and it probably, based on what you're saying, it probably does at least go that far. It would take the house out of the
If the will equation. Doesn't say where the house is going to go, then the house goes into the estate, and in North Carolina, isn't she going to have to agree to sell it if they had to sell it?
Well, again, this document's not on record, so it's not affecting title.
Right,
I mean, there's
right.
a lot of legal questions here about the effect of that document. We don't have a case on point
here that
says, well, if you sign a piece of paper, it says I write in the house, then this is what happens.
I agree that the document, ma'am, is the devil is all in the details relative to that document. I could not agree more. My take on it a bit is that it's going to be the burden would be very much so on the holder of this document, and it would be very suspect. In other words, a document such as that is really what one might call a postnuptial agreement. Okay,
uh-huh.
It's an agreement that evidently they made after they were married. After he maybe acquired this asset and put it in his own name, and now they're coming forward during their marriage and making some agreement as to that asset. Those kinds of agreements are extremely subject to being set aside, okay? Because what is the consideration for her waiver of her right in that house that's titled just in his name? You know, did she completely understand what she was signing at the time that she signed that document? Did she even know that she had this right to an elective share, which would automatically give her a right in that house? It doesn't matter that it's just titled in his name. That's the purpose of the elective share, is to give a surviving spouse as percentage of the net value, net assets of the estate, when in fact the estate is not titled in the name of the surviving spouse. We don't have a problem when assets are titled jointly.
Yes.
Okay,
right.
Or the house were tenants by entirety. The purpose of this.
But it would be better if he updated his will.
Well, of course, it would be better for him to update his will and or just make sure he even has a will. Because if he doesn't have a will, she has a right to his estate under the intestate succession law.
Right.
In the state of North Carolina.
I mean, if what we're trying to do is provide, some way for this surviving spouse, but, exclude the house from it, then we have to go back to what Cecil was talking about before. Let's plan for that. Let's put a trust together.
Right.
Let's find the house can be used, and placed in this trust for her lifetime if he dies first, but then it's going to pass back to his kids. I mean, there's a lot of questions here with regard to what we would want to accomplish, but the ultimate question that I think it was Barbara asked was, what would happen with regard to this document. And Cecil just so eloquently went through all of the three or four or five or six different legal obstacles this document would have to endure. And like I said, I think this is setting itself up for some court interpretation, which is not, where we want to send folks.
Thank you, Barbara. Appreciate your call. We'll have more to come in just a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. And, of course, you can find them online at harvellandcollins.com. Back with Cecil and Wes from Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law to talk about, again, the elective share and some of the, and now we need to look at some of the timing issues involved in it, right?
Right. That's really important. You know, as we've talked about on the program before, the law is dictated many times by time limitations, often called statute of limitations. Most of them dealing with like breach of contract claims, negligence, your standard. Type statute of limitations would be a 3-year statute of limitations from, let's say, the car accident or from the negligent act or from the breach of contract or the last payment on the promissory note.
Claim on a lien or the claim.
Yeah, unless the note's under seal, then it's 10 years. So, hey, us lawyers, we live by time. Because
and this is a case where time is of the essence.
That's right. This is a pretty short one. This is 6 months from the date that the letters – are issued. And what I mean by that is that when someone passes away, an estate is opened, letters testamentary if there's a will, or letters of administration if there's not a will, are issued by the clerk of court, bang, there's your time clock starts. You have 6 months from that time point, from the issuance of the letters, to file the petition for elective share. You have to do it during the lifetime of the surviving spouse. You can't do it through the surviving spouse's estate. If the surviving spouse, let's say, died a day after, you know, the first spouse, and you didn't file the petition for elective share, you can't do it. You can file it, however, through a power of attorney during the lifetime of the surviving spouse or through a guardianship. So this is not a fluid number at all. If we're on 6 months and one day, you've waived your right. So it's very important to keep that in mind. You know, and I would say, just listening to this, I'd say the average listener riding down the road this morning probably think, man, this is kind of complicated. What are you guys talking about?
It is complicated.
Yeah. But, you know, just keep in mind that if this scenario presents itself to, you know, a friend, a family member, your family, yeah, this is very important stuff. You know, I recently just wrapped up a case where, you know, the daughter of a man in a local man here's wife, second marriage, passed away, and they didn't know what assets she had and didn't really ask anything about the elective share. They were just worried about his being able to cover nursing home costs because he had to go into a nursing home. Well, it had been about 4 months since the spouse had died, so I asked if any type of elective share had been filed. What's that? That's the answer to that question.
Right.
I said, well, we need to file for that elective share. What assets does she have? I don't know. She acted like she had a lot of things, but I don't know what she had, so on and so forth. So we filed it. Well, and it just actually last week, this is about a year later. It took some time. We finally got this wrapped up, and an amount approaching $500,000 passed into the father's, my client's
account.
He ended up dying, so it ended up going into his estate. But we filed the petition for elective share in a timely manner, did it appropriately. There was a little bit of fighting about things, had to file a petition, had to go before the clerk of court, finally worked it out. But that was close to a $500,000 decision.
Wow.
So if they didn't just kind of trip into my office asking other things, that part of the family would have never received that. So it's powerful stuff. It's a little confusing, understand. But it is powerful, you know, to understand that there may be options in the event that there's a death, especially in a second or third marriage type scenario for the surviving spouse.
Right. Once again, these are the kinds of things that the planning does everything for you.
That's right.
Planning ahead.
A little bit of knowledge. Knowledge is power.
Yeah,
that's right.
And it's part of the law that a lot of people really do not understand, and probably the vast majority. And so it's something that you want to consult with the folks again at Harvell and Collins, attorneys of law, and ask them about these things and others plans as well too for your estate and your life. Call Harvell and Collins online at harvellandcollins.com, and you can reach them at 252-726-9050. That's 252-726-9050.